We do, as you might imagine, have a few seats up front. So if you're looking for a place to light, there you are. My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins and our board of directors, we want to welcome you to this program on the basics of Medicaid. Now, you know this, but I bet there are a lot of people who are watching this who don't. And that is, in terms of enrollment anyway, Medicaid is the biggest health insurance program in America. Over the course of the year, it covers more people than Medicare, 60 million or more, one in every five people in this country. And it's costly. Counting both the federal and state government shares, its price tag is somewhere between $340 or $380 billion this year. And there are three other things that you ought to know about Medicaid. Actually, there are probably a few more than three, but there are three that I'm going to take the time to share with you at this moment. First, it's incredibly important to the millions of low-income Americans that it serves. Second, it's incredibly complicated, and it's differently complicated in every state and other jurisdiction in which it functions. You'll hear more about that later. And third, it's a moving target, both nationally and in many states. The stimulus package that Congress may clear today has several Medicaid provisions, important ones. And on the other hand, a lot of states are grappling with budget woes and looking closely at their Medicaid program and how they are going to have to deal with those two items simultaneously. So we're really pleased to bring you this primer on the Medicaid program. Our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing, the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, is, a lot of you know, a project of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Diane Rowland, whom you'll hear from presently, is the executive director of the commission and, coincidentally, one of the country's leading Medicaid experts. Now, we want to not only welcome those of you who are here in the room, but also those of you on congressional staffs in state and district offices who are watching live on a webcast being brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org. We want you to understand the basics of this important program. You have casework to do sometimes. You have constituent questions, and we want to help you deal with those situations as well as we can. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll look forward to hearing from you later in the program. In your packets, those of you who are here, there's an awful lot of background information, including speaker bios that are more extensive than you'll hear from me. You'll also find all of the PowerPoint presentations in hard copy, and, of course, you'll see them on the screen. Those around the country can find the presentations on our website, which is allhealth.org. In a few days, you're going to be able to view a transcript of today's discussion and copies of the materials that those of you in the room have in hard copy. At both KaiserNetwork.org and AllHealth.org. Download a podcast, listen to it on the subway, you'll be edified. And at the appropriate time, those of you in the room are going to get a chance to ask questions. There are green cards in your packets. You can come to the microphones, of which there are three in the room, and there's a procedure in the that we've set up for state and district office folks to email the questions at the appropriate time to an address listed on our website. So before we go any further, let's get going with the program. We've got a terrific group of experts today. We've got presentations that you can follow along with in your packets and people who can answer any question you have about Medicaid, whether it's very simple or very complicated. So I want to start, obviously, with the gentlelady to my right, Diane Rowland, our first presenter, and she'll be co-moderating as well. She's, as I said, one of the country's foremost authorities on Medicaid, And as executive director of the Kaiser Commission and the executive vice president of the foundation, she deals with it almost every day. She's been a professional staff member on the Hill dealing with Medicaid. She's been in key positions in the executive branch. And excuse me, her task today is to give you a broad overview of the provisions of this important program. And we're very lucky to have you to set the stage for this discussion. Diane?
Thank you, Ed. I think what Ed just told you is that Medicaid's been around for a long time, and so have I. And so today we'll try and take you back a little bit to the roots of Medicaid and what it's developed to be, as well as try and explain some of the basics. This is not about policy choices for how Medicaid should be reformed or changed. This is about how a very complicated program takes care of very complex populations, and in doing that covers, as Ed said, a substantial share of the American population at a substantial cost to both the federal government and states and ultimately to all of us. What I wanted to start with, though, was to remind you that this is, in fact, an old program. It was enacted in 1965 as a companion to the Medicare legislation. It was intended to improve the state's ability to provide coverage to their welfare populations. It entitled eligible individuals to a defined set of benefits, but it did give states a great deal of leverage in that they could set benefits and provider payments and also the coverage under their own rules. It is and foremost has remained a means-tested program, so that it started with a focus on welfare, but it has always had income eligibility as one of its criterias. Yet it also started with a welfare hang-up, which is that welfare under the Elizabethan poor laws was really for aged, blind, and disabled individuals, as well as single parents with children. They were the needy poor, those who were without children and without families to support and without disabilities were not eligible for coverage under welfare, not eligible for coverage under Medicaid, no matter how poor. So when we talk about Medicaid, we always talk about its eligibility as income-related and categorically related. And over time, there's been some broadening of the categories and some broadening of the income, but the roots are there in the original thought that Medicaid would be the health insurance program for the welfare population. Today, Medicaid really goes far, far beyond that. And as a program, by the way, I should note, is under the jurisdiction of in the Senate Finance Committee, and in the House, the Energy and Commerce Committee. So those are the authorizing committees for this program. Today, Medicaid's coverage is broad and its roles are multiple, and I think that's the most important thing to remember about the program. We often hear it talked about mostly in connection with its role for low-income children in providing health insurance coverage to over almost 30 million of the nation's children, but it also is a key cornerstone of our long-term care system and the only place in which individuals can really turn for help with substantial long-term care bills. It also provides wraparound services to Medicare beneficiaries, filling in and paying their premiums, some of their cost sharing, and providing additional benefits that Medicare doesn't cover. Many like to say it is the Medicaid program that makes Medicare work for low-income beneficiaries. In doing that, it is a major component of our health insurance system, providing 16% of overall national health care spending, so it's a big payer and a big player in the health system, but especially a big payer and player for long-term care, where it covers some 42% of all long-term care institutional and home and community-based spending in the U.S. And as our other speakers, I'm sure, will address, it is a very big piece of state financing for care of their low-income population. Under a complicated formula known as the FMAP, it picks up between 50 and 76% of the spending that states encounter on Medicaid. States have to provide matching funds, and Barbara, I know, will get into more of that. It is the largest source of funding to the states. 44% of all federal funds to the states flow through Medicaid. And so I know many of you have probably been hearing about Medicaid in the context of the stimulus. That's one of the big pieces of getting additional federal support out during this economic downturn. I think it's also important to remember that Medicaid takes care of a wide range of individuals, and the selected populations for which it provides coverage are among the nation's poorest and sickest. It covers around 40% of the poor and 23% of the near poor. It leaves out, as I said, childless adults and many who don't meet the income eligibility tests in the states that are often far below the poverty level, especially for adults. It has a much more substantial role for children and covers more children than it does their low-income parents. It is a major source of coverage for pregnant women and covers some 41% of all births in the U.S. It covers 1 in 5 Medicare beneficiaries for those wraparound services, and it covers 20% of people with severe disabilities. As the nation has struggled with the HIV epidemic, it has been one of the sources of coverage for people with HIV/AIDS, and today covers about 44% of the individuals living with HIV/AIDS. And as I said, a major source of help for people in nursing homes, accounting for about 65% of the nursing home residents, although they continue to have to spend down and contribute toward the cost of their care, so it is not their full care that Medicaid is actually picking up. It is a program that is a joint partnership between the federal government and the states, and as I said, the states do have latitude over how they cover certain populations, what optional benefits, optional populations they wish to cover in their programs and still receive federal matching funds for them. And as you see from this slide, the percent of non-elderly residents covered by the program varies widely across the country, in part shaped by which states have higher concentrations of poverty and in part shaped by the eligibility rules and choices different states have made. Now, when we think about Medicaid, I think this is perhaps the slide that you should take away with you for the most in-depth understanding of the way in which this program is structured and how it actually operates. As I said, half of its enrollees are children, yet they account for only 18% of the program spending. So adding more children through an expansion of Medicaid and SCHIP is not going to increase substantially the spending under Medicaid in comparison to what it does to program spending when you expand coverage for people with severe disabilities or for the elderly, who account for, as you can see, 70% of overall spending in the program. And you can see the difference here very clearly when you look at the fact that the per capita spending on children and adults is far lower than that for the elderly and disabled. But I would just point out that acute care spending for people with disabilities is the highest part of their spending. So it is not just Medicaid's long-term care role that creates this inequity. When you look at how the eligibility rules work, you see here again what drives more children onto the program and fewer adults. The states have been given much more latitude through Medicaid and then through the CHIP program in combination, and now many cover children at or above 200% of poverty, with the median coverage for children at 200% of poverty, pregnant women closely behind. Whereas those who qualify through their disability or through being on the Supplemental Security Income Program, the cash assistance program for the aged and disabled, the median income is about 74% of poverty. And for working parents, it's much lower. For childless adults, doesn't even cross the threshold because they're not eligible unless covered by a waiver. And I would remind you that poverty is a very low income. It's $21,200 per year for a family of four in 2008, $22,000 this year. So we're talking about individuals with very few resources, which helps to explain why the benefits in the program tend to be comprehensive and the cost-sharing levels tend to be very limited. Again, this just really captures the fact that there is such substantial variation in coverage for children, and you look at the wide range of incomes covered across the country, and you see that in 17 states, in 11 states and D.C., children over 250% of poverty are eligible for the program today. And in stark contrast, you see that only in 18 states, parents are covered only below the federal poverty level, so that we in 18 states are covered at or above the federal poverty level, I'm sorry, but in 13 states they're covered below 49%, below 50% of poverty, less than $11,000 for a family of four. So one of the key issues in the program has been how do you bring better adult coverage levels up so that they begin to provide at least fuller coverage for families. And so in conclusion, I would say that in terms of being on the front line in healthcare reform, Medicaid has played and continues to play a substantial role in coverage of low-income adults and children, doing better by children, although there are still outreach and enrollment problems that many children who are eligible for the program are not participating. One of the goals of the new legislation extending SCHIP is to try and promote better enrollment practices to help get more eligible but unenrolled children covered. So that's the challenge for low-income children. But for parents and for adults without children, it really is getting the eligibility levels up so that they can be covered, and for adults without children, looking at ways to get around or remove the categorical restriction to move the program toward a more income-related program and less of a categorical program. So those are some of the challenges and structural issues in the program as it moves forward as both a health and long-term care program for our nation's lowest income citizens and others.
That's a terrific foundation. Thank you, Diane. Can I retrieve the clicker? Yes. There you go. By the way, there is a sheet in your materials. It's a salmon-colored sheet. If you have the hard copy, that details the 2009 poverty guidelines from HHS. Now we're going to hear from Barbara Edwards. She's a principal with the national research and consulting firm Health Management Associates. She ran Ohio's Medicaid program for 8 years. That's a $12 billion a year operation. She's been nationally recognized as a leader among Medicaid administrators for years, and pleased to say she has graced more than one alliance panel over that time. Today she's going to concentrate on Medicaid financing and on the state responsibilities for the program. Barbara, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, and it's always wonderful to see the size of the audience for these conversations. Medicaid is a wonderful program. It's a complex program, and it is central to so many solutions that we look to government to deliver, and in fact is increasingly a program that has a big impact on the private sector as well. I want to start in describing the state role in Medicaid by emphasizing the fact that Medicaid is a partnership program. It is a state-federal program. You've heard from Diane, there are federal parameters within which states administer the Medicaid program. There are state federal mandates for coverage, for benefits, and there are parameters for how states pay. But states have a great deal of discretion with regard to some optional services, optional populations, the design of the delivery system, and reimbursement. States buy in the general health care marketplace. This is not like the VA system where there are special hospitals or clinics built to serve the population. Medicaid consumers are consuming in the general marketplace, and Medicaid therefore interacts with that marketplace. Because states have some discretion around the design of the program, states file a state plan with the federal government, with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and Health and Human Services. The state plan describes how the state is going to manage the program. It commits the states to the mandatory activities under the program, and it also outlines the optional choices the state has made in terms of running the program. The Secretary of Health and Human Services has to review the state plan and any state plan amendments. Actually, CMS handles that for the Secretary. The Secretary also has the authority to waive many of the regulations and provisions of the Medicaid program to let states manage the program in ways that are outside the specific federal parameters. You hear a lot about waivers in the Medicaid program. They're a very important mechanism for design of the program. I'm not going to talk a lot about waivers today unless somebody asks a question. What's important is that once a state has an approved state plan or has approved terms and conditions with regard to any waivers, those become binding on the state in terms of running the program. It is an entitlement program for the folks that are described in the state plan. I was asked to speak today about how states finance Medicaid, and I was inclined to tell you that if I told you, I'd have to kill you. But it's actually a little more straightforward than that, despite some of the press that states get around financing. States pay for services for Medicaid and receive reimbursement from the federal government for a portion of those service costs. The federal medical assistance percentage is the FMAP describes the percentage of the federal share, and it is specific to each state. The FMAP is a minimum of 50% and ranges up. In 2009, the state that had the highest federal share of the program was Mississippi at 75.67%. The FMAP varies based on the relationship of a state's per capita income to the national per capita income. It is adjusted annually. It's based on prior years' rolling experience. It's one of the challenges states have with FMAP because the FMAP you have today doesn't reflect what's going on in your state today with regard to per capita income. It reflects what was going on average in recent years. So it means that it doesn't change very quickly to reflect what may be happening in the current marketplace. But this is a longstanding formula for the determination of FMAP. The FMAP for administrative costs, which are very low in the Medicaid program. States run Medicaid for about 3 to 5% of the total program costs. The federal share of administrative costs is set at 50%, regardless of the state's per capita income. And there are some enhanced percentages around the development and operation of the information systems that support Medicaid. The picture here, the map, shows the different FMAP percentages for the various states, and as you can see, the states in white are the states that are getting the 50% FMAP. They are relatively higher per capita income states, and the states, it gets progressively darker as states are poorer, and they get much higher rates of federal match. Now, when states buy Medicaid services, they have to put up state dollars and then get reimbursed. And the source of the financing at the state level is also relatively straightforward, except that it's in the tax codes, and there's almost nothing straightforward about tax codes. States finance Medicaid out of appropriations from state or local general revenue funds, and that is the bulk of the way that most states identify the dollars that are spent to support the Medicaid services. There are also defined in federal law and regulation permissible health-related taxes that are used in most states to raise additional revenue to help finance Medicaid. And this would be a tax, for example, on hospitals in the state. The state collects the revenue from the hospitals. They use that revenue in funding the Medicaid program, and those tax dollars then become eligible for federal matching funds. Or taxes on nursing homes is often a common provider tax. We hear a lot about this. There are federal regulations about permissible use of those taxes. It's basically about being sure that the tax is spread broadly across all providers of similar type in the system, and that no provider gets an absolute guarantee that 100% of their tax dollar will always be refunded through Medicaid reimbursement. Other ways that states fund Medicaid, again, generally out of general revenue funds, is through things called intergovernmental transfers and certified public expenditures. And what this really means is that sometimes the appropriation, rather than going to the Medicaid agency, goes to a sister state agency, say the Department of Mental Health or the Department of Aging. Dollars from that system can be transferred into Medicaid to buy services under Medicaid and be matchable, or it might be a transfer from a public hospital in the state. And then certified public expenditures means that a public provider has spent money for an allowable Medicaid consumer for an allowable service, and they can certify that they've spent those dollars, and then the state can file a claim with the federal government for the match rate. These are important mechanisms in the state, but they basically all come out of the state's tax base one way or the other. Medicaid is a huge challenge for states when it comes to budgeting. The major reason it's a huge challenge is that it's a huge part of every state's budget. It's on average about 22% of total spending in state budgets. It goes head-to-head with primary and secondary education as the single largest item in a state's budget. States make a massive commitment to the Medicaid program. The challenge for Medicaid is that because Medicaid costs typically grow faster than state revenues grow, Medicaid over years tends to crowd out other priorities in state budgets. States have to balance their budgets every year so they don't get to sort of average it out over a period of time or borrow funds and hope, you know, that somebody in the future is going to be able to figure out how to pay for that. They have to balance it every day. So if Medicaid dollars are growing, the spending is growing faster than the state revenues, Medicaid takes up a bigger space in the state budgets and crowds out other priorities. Medicaid grows because of medical inflation, which grows faster than the general economic growth in the country, because we have an aging population, and as we get older, we use more healthcare services, and because of policy changes. We actually deliberately grow Medicaid to add more people to the coverage or to put new treatments on the program. Sometimes we grow Medicaid in response to specific congressional opportunities to use Medicaid in broader ways. So it is, and the biggest reason Medicaid can grow and create a problem in the short term is because Medicaid is designed to be countercyclical. When I say countercyclical, I mean this. Because Medicaid is an income-based entitlement, when the economy declines and unemployment grows, people who've looked at this have said that a 1% increase in unemployment translates into 1 million new people enrolled in Medicaid in the SCHIP program at the state level, which in turn translates into $3.4 billion in additional spending, state and federal, even as the state's revenues are dropping because of the increase in unemployment. And when you look on the next picture, you will see what the country looked like in the last recession. The yellow bars show the state's revenue change from year to year from 1997 to 2006. You can definitely see a recession taking place there. And the red bar shows the increase of Medicaid spending from year to year during that same 10-year period. This is the countercyclical nature of Medicaid, and it's why the governors get a little worried when the economy drives. So states have a challenge to control Medicaid spending. In the short term, the challenge is balancing the budget within the 12 months of this budget. And states really only have three options for doing that. You can restrict who you cover within the optional populations, you can restrict the optional benefits, or you can restrict what you pay providers. And when you look at the last recession, particularly 2003 and 2004, what you see is that states did everything that they could do during that period to try to slow the rate of growth in Medicaid so that they could keep it within the bounds of a balanced budget. You'll notice that, in fact, almost every state undertook efforts to control the spending on pharmacy. 100% of the states cut or froze provider reimbursement, and that half the states in 2003 and almost half the states in 2004 actually did restrict eligibility, and almost as many states restricted benefits during that time period. When states look at Medicaid costs out into the future, the cost containment challenge looks a little different. This shows a projection by CBO that Medicaid's total spending, state and federal dollars, will increase to $736 billion by 2017, which is a doubling of the program spending from 2007. So when states look at this, they're trying to figure out how actually to bend the trend in Medicaid growth from year to year, not balancing the budget just on a year-to-year basis, but actually slowing the rate of growth from year to year so that that total spending on Medicaid becomes more manageable. These are longer-term strategies that involve more reforms to how healthcare is delivered, to how coverage is designed, to the nirvana of healthcare consumer behavior and how that contributes to the cost of healthcare, and trying to slow the erosion in the private dollars in healthcare so that fewer people would be falling into Medicaid coverage. The final point I'll make is that Medicaid buys in the healthcare marketplace. It is not a system that can be managed in isolation of what is going on in the larger healthcare arena. It impacts the larger marketplace, but it is also impacted by it. And it's not, while it's a large buyer, it's not large enough to totally control what's going on in the rest of the healthcare delivery system. It's got to be a part of a larger context. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Barbara. And our final speaker is Dr. Andrew Bindman. Andy's professor of medicine and health policy, among other topics, at the University of California, San Francisco. He's a primary care doc. He runs the California Medicaid Research Institute. And today he's going to concentrate on Medicaid's impact on access to care, as well as some of the service delivery and provider payment issues that you've heard touched on already. Andy, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm already relieved by one thing I heard. Barbara said that states have to balance their budget each year. So being from a state that's is challenging that concept, I'm glad to hear it'll end by the end of this fiscal year. So I'm going to try to talk a little bit about from the perspective of what goes on with regard to the importance of Medicaid as a program to provide access to care, and we'll speak about... So you've heard some reference to this today in Diane's part of the talk, but this sort of gives you a little bit more of a granular feel for where Medicaid is spending its money. If you look at this pie chart as being the total of $304 billion spent in 2006, you can see that a little over 58%, or the kind of yellow lime shaded part of the pie, is for acute care services. That's things like inpatient hospitalizations, payments to to physicians and to laboratories and for diagnostic x-rays, about 6.8% to outpatient clinics, 5.5% for medications, and also 18%, you can see at bottom, to managed care organizations, which I'll come back and talk a little bit about later on. About another, a little over a third of the spending in Medicaid is also spent on long-term care, and Diane referred to that. And again, it's something to emphasize that many people don't necessarily first think about Medicaid as a program that is supporting long-term care. I think a lot of people get confused between Medicare and Medicaid, thinking, Medicare is for the elderly. Well, in fact, it's Medicaid that plays such a significant role in long-term care in the way that Diane alluded to in her comments. And this is in nursing home care services, in home and community-based services to keep people in their homes who need additional support, and a variety of other programs for people in intermediate care facilities and people with chronic mental illness and the like. Now, Barbara just touched on the fact that Medicaid purchases in the general marketplace, and this just gives you a sense of what kinds of services Medicaid is purchasing. If you take a look at on the left-hand side, you can see that Medicaid is buying about 16% of services in the marketplace as a percentage of total health services and supplies. Hospital care is, they purchase about 17% in the United States. Professional services, which would include things like payments to physicians, is 13%. Nursing home care is where its biggest purchasing clout is. In nursing homes is 42%. And prescription drugs, 8% of the U.S. total. There are ways of trying to gauge how important Medicaid is as a program to provide access to care. I'm not going to be able to provide you with all of that today, but this just gives you one glimpse into that. And the take-home message here is that Medicaid is extremely important. And, in fact, it probably provides for many of the vulnerable patients that you've heard about access to care that is much more comparable to the private insurance market than it is to those who are uninsured. And so if you look at, and this is broken out by adults and children, one important measure of access to care is whether someone has a usual source of care. You can see that among adults, 52% of uninsured persons have no usual source of care, whereas 10% of those in the Medicaid program and 10% of those who have private insurance report that phenomenon. So Medicaid looks very similar to private insurance in that context. Similar comparison there for children with regard to no usual source of care. Children are a little bit more likely than adults to have a usual source of care, but again, Medicaid looks more similar to private insurance than it does to the uninsured. And that really shows you the important role it plays, because if people who are eligible for Medicaid were not getting Medicaid, in general, they would be uninsured. Another measure is whether people had needed care but they were did not get it. Again, what you see is that Medicaid has a profile of individuals reporting that is much more comparable to those with private insurance than it is to those who are uninsured, although there are some small differences. The adults, a slightly higher percentage of those on Medicaid do report this difficulty compared to adults with private insurance. So I'm not trying to say that it's exactly comparable to private insurance, but I would say on the spectrum between private insurance and uninsured that Medicaid comes out much closer to private insurance than it does to those who are uninsured. What I want to talk about a little bit is picking up where Barbara just alluded to some of the challenges in state budgets, is to think about what impact what state budget challenges will mean in terms of potentially undermining access to care for those on Medicaid. And in particular, I want to comment on issues raised about whether challenges in state budgets might result in reductions in provider payments, reductions in enrollment in the program, and the use of managed care in Medicaid. This comes from the reliable medical reference of The New Yorker, who makes the general comment, is there a doctor who accepts Medicaid in the house? And this is a cartoon that didn't just come out this year. It's been around for a long time. There have been issues for a long period of time about whether there are sufficient numbers of providers participating in the Medicaid program. And this gives you some sense of the trends with regard to that. You can see on your left-hand side that when surveyed, physicians report that among those who will say they will take all new patients, only about 50% say that to be the case for Medicaid. And that was true in 1996, and it's essentially 52% in 2004 and 2005 when they were resurveyed. That in contrast to physicians with regard to taking all new patients who are either privately insured or who are covered by Medicare, the program for those over age 65, and you can see that many more physicians are open to taking new patients with that type of insurance as compared to Medicaid. And switching over to the right-hand side of the graphic, you can see that if anything, over time, there has been a slight uptick in the number of physicians reporting that they're taking Medicaid patients at all in their practice. So it's up to 21% in 2004-2005 nationally. Again, if you looked at private or Medicare, it's in the single digits the number of physicians who would say that they wouldn't take any new patients either with private insurance or with Medicare insurance. So getting physicians to participate in this program is a challenge. I want to make sure you understand that physicians' participation in Medicaid is voluntary. They're not required to take Medicaid patients. And some of the reasons that physicians cite for why they don't take Medicaid patients in their practice have to do in part with some of the characteristics and complexities of the patients in terms of the challenges they may present in an office-based setting. There are long-standing statements made by physicians about their concerns about being sued, although I want to say that there's a significant amount of data to suggest that this is actually an unfounded myth in the sense that many on Medicaid probably sue at a significantly lower rate than those in the general population. But it is a concern out there among providers in terms of why some say they don't take Medicaid patients. And then administrative hassles and payment delays, the challenges of filling out extensive paperwork or the delays in getting payment from Medicaid have left many private providers saying that they don't want to do it, to the extent that there are many physicians who report that even when they take Medicaid patients, they don't go through the exercise of actually billing for it because of the hassles or delays of getting paid. The strongest predictor, however, of whether a physician will participate in the program has to do with the state payment rates, and states do get to determine what they want to pay in the Medicaid program to providers. One way that this is described when looked at across states is a payment relative to the amount that's typically paid for a Medicare patient in the state, and so that you'll often see the Medicaid to Medicare payment ratio for providers And on average across the United States, it's about 70% payment for Medicaid as compared to what the Medicare payment is in that state. There are also, and this just gives you some feel for what I'm describing in terms of participation rates of physicians in relationship to the payment rates in different states. Nationally, about 62% of all physicians were accepting of Medicaid patients, but if you looked at the low-fee states, that was only 52% of physicians versus the high-fee states, about 68% of physicians. So some real differences there related to the payment rates. And you can also see that it differs a little bit between primary care and specialist physicians, where specialist physicians are a little bit more likely to have some Medicaid patients in their practice compared to primary care physicians. But again, that same differential between low-fee states having lower participation rates compared to higher-fee states. I'll transition a little bit now to talk about some of the issues related to eligibility. One of the things you need to understand about the Medicaid program as an entitlement program is that any person who meets Medicaid eligibility is entitled to the benefit. There is no wait list, if you will, for the service. Now, to do this determination of eligibility, the federal requirement is that this be done at least on an annual basis. However, states do have the discretion of deciding to do that more frequently if they deem that to be what they want to do in that state. And many states do, in fact, do it more frequently. And the one thing that is clear from this, however, is that the frequency of determining eligibility and the ease of that process within a state will affect the number of potentially eligible beneficiaries who end up truly being enrolled in the program or who will experience gaps in their enrollment. And this comes from some work that we have looked at in California, where, in fact, there was kind of a natural experiment in our state where the requirement for demonstrating eligibility among children in California was changed in 2001 from a frequency of every 6 months to a frequency of every 12 months. And what happened during that time period was that there was a significant increase in the percentage of children from 49% to 62% who had continuous Medicaid coverage throughout the year. They did not experience gaps in coverage. And it has been shown nationally that these gaps in coverage are typically of 2 to 4 months in duration, and that they're not generally the type of gaps that you would typically see related to market fluctuations in the income of a family, but are probably most likely seen in association with kind of the administrative challenges that can come up with maintaining enrollment in the program. We further have looked into this in California to see what kind of health impact does it mean for a beneficiary if they have a gap in coverage. And we looked at hospitalization rates for conditions like asthma and diabetes and congestive heart failure, things for which hospitalizations are viewed as preventable because, in fact, we have many good outpatient treatments for those conditions. And along the bottom, the orange bar, are those individuals in California who had continuous coverage over a 5-year period and what their rates of hospitalizations were for these preventable conditions over the 5 years. And you can see that the probability of a hospitalization for those conditions was about 2% among those with continuous coverage, whereas those in the yellow line, the interrupted, those who had gaps in coverage, experienced dramatically higher rates of hospitalizations for these conditions when you track them out. And typically, it is in those first few months after losing coverage that someone would be much more likely to have a hospitalization for a preventable condition that could generally be treated in the outpatient setting, but because of the lack of coverage, often are not getting medications to maintain their health and the like, becoming sicker and resulting in a hospitalization, and a more costly part of the healthcare system has to step in to take care of people. Finally, I want to just draw your attention to the fact that the Medicaid program is delivered through managed care in the majority of most states. That isn't to say that every beneficiary in all those states is in a managed care program, but in most states, managed care is being used for at least some or a substantial number of Medicaid beneficiaries. The benefits ascribed to this delivery model have to do with the potential to try to improve access to care through the requirement of a beneficiary having a primary care provider. And I want to emphasize that because the fee-for-service delivery model of Medicaid has not traditionally had a requirement that an individual have a primary care medical home or a primary care doctor. And so there are some real opportunities through things like managed care to, in fact, get a beneficiary connected with a primary care home that can help do prevention and education to help people stay healthier, which is obviously one of the real goals of the health insurance program. There are some concerns that are raised about the use of managed care as a delivery model, that managed care in general has been talked about as something that might limit access to high-cost services like specialists. And so there is, on the one hand, some arguments about the benefits of Medicaid managed care as access to primary care, but some offsetting concerns by others that, in fact, it may be used as a tool to try to contain costs. I will say that as states look at ways of trying to find more efficiency and value for their Medicaid dollars, that there are discussions underway in many states, like California, to expand the use of mandatory Medicaid managed care for a larger proportion of their beneficiaries in the hope that this would be ultimately both a good way to provide access and to be a good value for the Medicaid dollar. I thought I had one other slide, but I guess it maybe got cut off, which was a state slide. I have it on my handout, but it's not there. It should be in your handouts, which shows the national picture of the country and the relative proportion of Medicaid beneficiaries in Medicaid managed care in those states. So hopefully you have that at least in your handout, and you can see the relative penetration in the different states. Oh, it's missing from the handout as well. Well, I apologize. I will try to make up for that. But it does vary across the country. I guess I'll just sum up by saying that Medicaid is an extremely important program with providing access to care for some of our most vulnerable individuals in the country. And it's also a program that, because of the financing that was described by Barbara, there are challenges that can undermine the ability of the program to maintain access. And this is something that is going to require careful attention as policy decisions are made going forward. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks very much, Andy. And we'll make sure that we post that unseen slide on our website, and it'll be on kaisernetwork.org as well. Now we get a chance for you to ask the questions that have been raised by the presentations or by the gaps in your own knowledge or what we chose to cover in those presentations. You have three microphones in the audience. I would urge you to use those microphones. Try to be as brief as you can with those questions. You don't have to be simple. You don't have to be complicated, but we would ask you to be brief. Identify yourself. Those of you who are in the state and district offices, let me just remind you, if you want to submit a question by email, if you'll go to the Alliance website, allhealth.org, the top item is about this briefing, and if you click on the Read More button there, you'll land on a page that describes the briefing and shows you exactly how to send an email to ask a question. So we'll start first with the folks who are lined up at each of the microphones, and that gentleman was the first person at any microphone.
Hi, Joe Hutter, Senate Help. Basically, the flexibility of the state Medicaid programs can be a great source of experimentation. At the same time, there's a blizzard of eligibility rules that nobody can understand. If you're a patient, it's very living in that state, it's very difficult to understand them. There's no one at the federal level seems to understand these. In fact, there's a national Medicaid expert who says there's no such thing as a national Medicaid expert. It's all at the state level. And then certainly for anyone trying to do cross-state analysis. Given that, is there any type of consensus that you guys are thinking about in your backroom discussions with each other about how to simplify and streamline while at the same time preserving some of the flexibility that gives rise to experimentation?
Barbara?
I'll start. We used to say that, you know, federal and state agencies would have to go find the one person at the federal level that understood the rules and the one person at the state level that understood how the state had put it together and let them talk about eligibility. It is enormously complicated. It's probably the single biggest challenge of the Medicaid program. It's not that it is a program for low-income people. It's a program for people who fall into a set of boxes. I think there are over 50 federally defined eligibility categories, plus states have options. And even within those categories, states can decide how to count income and assets and all sorts of things. You're right, it's enormously complicated, and I think it's a big challenge for the program. It's also how the program has been so flexible to solve so many different kinds of problems. But states have for many years been saying that, that they'd like to see more simplification around the eligibility program. The challenge, of course, is they don't really want someone else to tell them how to do that. There are some states that are trying to experiment with simplification. Wisconsin, I think, is a state that has worked really hard at filing a series of waivers to try to find a way to make eligibility an easier concept in their state. One of the proposals that comes forward from time to time from various groups has to do with making Medicaid just an, you know, a set single income base, and everybody under poverty was covered by Medicaid. That would be a lot easier to understand. So there are ideas out there about how to do it. The challenge is that applying any new definition to all of the existing programs creates winners and losers, and there's always the fear that some states would have to spend more money if you went to a new standard, and some states would be concerned they would lose the ability to cover some of the people they currently cover. But it's an area that you, I don't think you'd get any argument from states deserves attention.
I think it's also an area where if you look at the policy toward children, we've moved toward trying to get to at least a more standard base, even though you give states the flexibility to go above that with higher income, so that all children under poverty must be covered or must be eligible for Medicaid. So I think in looking at the way you simplify the program, you have this hard choice of where do you draw the federal minimums to make everything the same across states, and then where do you give states the flexibility to go above that and do more. But as Barb said, there's always a tension when Congress looks at it to keep these groups grandfathered who were once covered. And I think one of the real challenges in going forward is to say, in the effort to make this fair and simple, we may have to get rid of some of what we call these grandfathered groups.
Yes, Bob? Let me just say, by the way, I did not mention again that you can, if you do not want to go to a microphone, fill out a green question card and hold it up, and someone from the staff will bring it forward. Yes, go ahead.
Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. All of the speakers have talked about how the Medicaid program really just purchases health care in the marketplace, and it represents only a sliver of that marketplace, maybe 20%. In previous briefings, we often hear about different degrees of inefficiency in healthcare delivery systems. For example, the Dartmouth Atlas shows tremendous variation, sometimes as high as 500% between some states and other states in the utilization of Medicare services. I'm struck by the lack of options that the states have in being more efficient in the way they use their Medicaid dollars. They can challenge, they can restrict the eligibility, they can restrict the reimbursement level, and they can restrict the benefit package themselves. But I'm wondering, it seems like the Medicaid program is the most significant liability that the state faces for having an inefficient healthcare delivery system. In the 60s and 70s, after Medicare and Medicaid was developed, the federal government was interested in healthcare planning processes in order to avoid inefficiencies in healthcare delivery. We had certificate of need processes and state health plans. I'm wondering if there is any effort on states' parts to expand their community health planning mechanisms so that the entire healthcare marketplace that they purchase in is more efficient, effective, and equitable. That's not an option I often hear talked about as a strategy for dealing with rationing healthcare services, and yet it seems to me the most useful one for states to be thinking about.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent comment. I'll just speak a little bit to what I observe in California with regard to this, which is that I think many states, if they're like California, suffer from the lack of the kinds of data that they need to be able to make good value-based purchasing, to know about quality of care. The kinds of data systems that are structured in many Medicaid programs follow very traditional fee-for-service type models of a service was done, we're going to pay for it, with very little ability to judge the quality of the service that was delivered. I think some of the attractiveness of managed care organizations for Medicaid, at least again in California, has been that at least in managed care, there has been some development of accountability measures like HEDIS and so forth to try to make judgments about the quality of care. And there is some activity going on in many Medicaid managed care plans in different states to try to incentivize on the basis of some of those kinds of HEDIS measures or things like that. In general, I think your point is exactly right, that it's a much more productive way to think about looking at the financial challenges to combine it with information about quality so that either selective contracting or different kinds of methods can be used based on purchasing quality that will be important. But I think Medicaid programs have a long way to go to revamp their data systems to allow them to have the information they need to be able to do that kind of work. And I'd be interested to know about states that are doing a good job at that. I think we're still at a very rudimentary state in my own backyard.
Barb, you want to add to that or not?
I'd only add that I agree with everything that Andy said, but it is a political environment, and every Medicaid dollar that is spent is somebody's revenue. So it is extremely difficult to restrict where the public dollar is going to be spent when those local providers, that are often the largest employers in local communities, take their case to the legislature as well and to the administrations in states. So I think the issue, you need real power behind the information on which you would be making those kinds of decisions, and I would agree that right now a lot of that information is pretty lacking.
Yes.
I'm Stuart Miller with American Fathers. We represent a very large number of unwed fathers in low-income families, low-income divorced fathers who are ineligible for Medicare or Medicaid merely because of their custodial status. Is there any effort underway to recognize these parents and to make an outreach to them so they can become covered? And if not, why not?
You know, I think you raised a really good point when we talked about Medicaid is not a program for people based on income. It's based on whether or not you fall into one of the many categories of eligibility. And non-custodial parents is not one of those boxes that is defined in the federal law with regard to eligibility. Some states have made some progress at covering adults who do not have dependent children through waiver programs and other kinds of strategies to try to expand coverage generally to low-income workers. But I'm not aware of states that have reached out specifically to non-custodial parents. I think states are more often looking at the broader issue of, can you reach uninsured adults who don't have dependent children? I think there's a lot of interest in that issue for states.
Yes, go ahead.
Chris Jacob. Chris Jacobs with the House Republican Conference. During the debate on the stimulus bill, there was a provision in the House passed legislation was not in the final conference report to extend Medicaid to anyone receiving unemployment compensation, regardless of income or assets. At the Energy and Commerce Committee markup, Republicans offered an amendment to cap an income cap to limit eligibility for Medicaid to those making under $1 million. So some of the fired CEOs that helped cause the current economic crisis would not be eligible. Chairman Waxman surprisingly opposed this measure, and it's interesting the reason why he said, I think it is highly unlikely that you are going to find millionaires who would like to go on Medicaid. So do you agree with Chairman Waxman's comment that millionaires would not like to go on Medicaid even though it would be provided free? Why might he say something like that? And if it's unacceptable for millionaires to go on it and they would not want to go on it even though they're getting it for free, then why is it a good form of coverage for 60 million low-income and vulnerable Americans?
Well, clearly, you pose a very interesting dilemma as one looks at Medicaid eligibility and who would enroll. What we know is that the process for enrolling is not always the easiest process, and so I think one could easily think that while low-income families are used to going through the application process, showing their paychecks, showing their documentation for eligibility, that others who have lived a different kind of life may not be as anxious to do that. What we have found in some focus groups that we've been doing around the country is that there are many people who have recently lost their jobs, lost their health insurance coverage, are ineligible for the COBRA extension, perhaps because they didn't even have health insurance through their jobs before, who are coming to Medicaid and applying and finding out that just their very unemployment check puts them over the income eligibility levels for the Medicaid program. So I think there are serious problems in terms of using this program as a stopgap unless you do open up the income and eligibility levels for a short period of time to let people on. We found in one of the waivers that was enacted right after 9/11 in New York that there was the same criticism that everyone was going to start applying for Medicaid because it was opened up without any requirement for a severe income test, and yet the people that applied tended to be the people for whom Medicaid was more a part of their life, food stamps, Medicaid, other things. So I think there's a expectation that if you opened it up, you'll get millionaires on the program, but I think the reality has been that millionaires usually have other choices than people who are moderate income and modest income individuals. I think when you open up the program also, you see the kinds of issues that Andy Beinman has talked about in terms of access, and so we do know some of the problems with the Medicaid program are that we give people eligibility to the program, but they may have difficulty maintaining their coverage or finding a doctor who'll see them. And so I suppose the other comment would be millionaires maybe have a different set of providers that they're used to going to than those that accept the Medicaid program.
Just one follow-up comment. I would say that Medicaid, when people have disabilities or have family members who have a really serious disability, there's a pretty strong interest in getting access to Medicaid coverage for people at much higher incomes than poverty. So, again, I think it is a strong program in terms of it providing benefits that are not generally available otherwise, and that for children with disabilities, families can have pretty strong incomes and be working very hard in their states to get Medicaid expanded to allow their children access to those long-term care services and supports that private coverage doesn't provide. So there, and those millionaires' grandparents might be having Medicaid coverage if they're receiving long-term care services. So I think, again, Medicaid is many programs, and the public, general public, reacts differently to different pieces of it.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Sue Ellen Galbraith with American Network of Community Options and Resources, and we represent providers of supports, community living and employment supports. And I'd like to go back to the issue of reimbursement and ask, what are the requirements in the Medicaid statute regarding reimbursement rates, and particularly focused on one that is a real issue right now, prompt payment, And I think, Dr. Benman, as you well know, in California, when there was the legislature failed to come to a budget agreement last summer, providers under the state law could not be paid. And that meant that many of our members in California, and they were mostly nonprofits, were not able to be reimbursed for several months. So when you're the prompt payment issue, and then you move into a very economically challenged or recession, that becomes an issue. And I know that was addressed a little bit in the recovery package, but I think it's been pulled back to just refer to hospitals and nursing homes, the prompt payment requirement.
You know, this is an issue that as you point out, sort of combines a lot of different, your question combines a lot of different situations. One is, what do states do when they literally have no cash? And sometimes what states choose to do then might not be what they would argue is their best policy, but it may be what they can do. And I know in my state, there are state-specific laws with regard to prompt pay for all government payers. Not every state has that, or it might not apply to all contractors. But in my state, if we got to the end of the year and we're a little tight, trust me, we paid very close attention to whether or not holding up a check would cause us to trigger the interest penalty that we would owe if we paid outside of 30 days. So that can vary at a state level with regard to policy. At the federal level, there are some requirements around prompt pay with regard to Medicare plans, managed care plans. But I think that for the most part, those issues are really state-level issues in terms of how the state government relates to its obligations.
But there are requirements regarding reimbursement.
Oh, with regarding reimbursement in general,
the
yes.
Federal level.
There are, and again, they can vary by the type of provider, type of service that's being delivered. Some services, for example, hospice services, if the state chooses to offer hospice, they have to use the federal reimbursement and the federal definition. Certain hospital outpatient service, lab services have to use the Medicare schedule. Other services, states have HMO. If you have a managed care plan, the federal law says that the rates have to be actuarially sound. Doesn't say exactly what that process is, but it says it has to be actuarially sound. Other rates have to be, I think, consistent with efficiency, economy, and appropriate access to care. So again, it tends not to be a very rigid federal standard. It tends to be one that gives states considerable discretion in figuring out how to assure appropriate access in their state within their resources. And states obviously would argue that that's the way it needs to be.
Thank you.
Before we take another question from microphone, we've got a bunch of green card questions. We're probably not going to get to all of them, or it's going to be difficult, so I urge you to, if you're really impelled to get an answer, to go to a microphone. Diane?
This question, Andy, maybe goes best to you. Since Medicaid participation by healthcare providers is voluntary, are there strategies that states can use to ensure that there are enough providers for all eligible Medicaid beneficiaries?
I think it's a great question about how states can try to encourage providers to participate. I think there are some clues from some of the things that we've learned from focus groups and surveys of doctors. So some of it has to do with the last question about the delays in payment and the attending to administrative hassles with regard to payment. States will vary tremendously with what the makeup is of their provider network. In some areas, there's a lot of focus on investments being made and working partnerships with community clinics and other sites that may take on a large proportion of the Medicaid population and to try to work effectively to either create rates that are more workable in those settings or have other kinds of infrastructure supports. The biggest thing I guess I'll say is that if you look at kind of why participation drops off, it kind of happens in these sometimes that there are kind of dwindling participation rates, but we see steep drops when we have things that are going on now, and that is if there are either freezes or more dramatic, as was proposed in California, rollbacks in payment rates. I think this sometimes provides a window in which providers sort of feel like they've crossed over a line and may not be willing to then stay involved. And even if those things are made up for over time, it's very hard to re-engage those providers back, and so that you're sort of waiting for a new generation of providers who maybe didn't experience that. So I think there is, it's very harmful in terms of these fairly dramatic things that happen economically that may lead to results like rolling back on payments, that you could then shed a very large number of providers. And I think it's something we need to pay careful attention to right now. Those numbers that I showed you in my talk were from a couple of years ago, and I would not be surprised if, certainly anecdotally, our sense is in California, where rollbacks were proposed, that there may be more providers dropping out. So I think providers look for consistency in terms of their relationship with a payer.
Barbara, you want to add?
I want to just add that there are some challenges that are bigger than just sort of can you get a decent rate out there. There are some specialties, for example, where there just appears to not be enough to go around to meet the need. And as those providers, whether it's psychiatric providers or in some cases might be dental providers, where there's been a, there's a pretty strong control over who's getting into the market to sell those services. I think there's a sense of that with dental. And to the extent that providers have the ability to sort of not deal with any third-party payers, we see some providers who sort of remove themselves from being available, even if, in fact, they might not even want to see the Medicare patient or maybe a Blue Cross patient. So there are challenges. The other challenge that Medicaid deals with is that, you know, where the patients live and where the physicians have their offices may not be in the same place. So you may have lots of docs in the suburbs, and they may not be seeing a lot of Medicaid folks, but even if they open their doors, you may have a lot of the people that have Medicaid coverage not be able to access geographically those services. If the hospital pulls up stakes from the inner city and moves out to where the population is growing and has better private coverage, again, you have a real challenge with access potentially for some populations. So those kinds of issues are also need to be taken into consideration when you're thinking about what those challenges are. There are both structural and reimbursement and even cultural issues where some doctors are very committed, some providers are very committed to mission in terms of service, and others may feel less of a commitment to serving indigent populations.
Yes, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm Phil Sarnowski with Booz Allen Hamilton. Some of the discussion so far has hinted at looking at other states for best practices and conducting the program. And my question is aimed for the whole panel, but I'd be interested to hear what Barbara Edwards has to say. But how much collaboration actually formally exists and informally exists between states? And when you were running the Ohio program, how often were you influenced by what other states were doing, not just in terms of enrollment, but in terms of staffing the program and all aspects of spending within the program? And how much are other states learning from other states? And I guess for the entire panel, is this something we can do better?
Well, I'll start since you asked. You know, I think states are very interested in how other states are doing the Medicaid business. I think it's one of the reasons that one of the Kaiser surveys that HMA has the privilege of helping to pull together on the state budgets that is done every year, states eat that up. They can't wait to find out, you know, how their policies are evolving and how it's happening in other states, whether they're all sharing the same kinds of challenges. The state Medicaid leadership is very interested in learning from the peers in the business. That said, there is another reality, and that is every state is very different. States' attitudes toward tax policy, states' attitudes toward healthcare spending, whether states are conservative or liberal, whether states have a tradition of large public programs or small public programs, those things can be very different, and those also have heavy influence over the options that a state really has in going forward. So there is more sharing. I think states would always say more sharing is better. There have been a few states in the New England area, for example, that have actually tried to collaborate in some purchasing around some of the infrastructure services, some of the processing, administrative kinds of services. But each state's procurement policies are different and established in law. And so, again, it can be sort of difficult to operate across those state lines. I think there is sort of a growing interest in where there might be the opportunity to take advantage of state interstate collaboration, but it's pretty complicated.
Also add that, you know, in addition to the state administrators, there's a lot of interest in state legislators about learning from other states, and we do some work with the National Conference of State Legislatures to bring together the key legislators at the state level on Medicaid and on some of their other health financing programs. And one of the challenges there increasingly, however, is that there's a lot of turnover because of term limits, so that we're often doing more 101s with the state legislators than really being able to engage in some shared practices. But there clearly is a lot of interest in learning. The other thing we watch very carefully is that travel is not a possibility for many at the state level. And so that's one way that I think doing things like this kind of a webcast, but also other web-related briefings that can disseminate some of these practices across states are important.
The National Association of State Medicaid Directors is one of the sources that states look to facilitate the communication across states. In the area of HIT in particular, it's a good example. The states that have received grants under the Deficit Reduction Act funding for a system change have formed a collaborative across those states so they can get together and learn from each other as they're developing information technology strategies for Medicaid. So, again, I think the infrastructure to support that is important because there's not only turnover at the legislative level, there's often frequent turnover at the Medicaid director level as well, and folks are often on a new learning curve.
I just want to add one brief other comment. In my experience is that one of the things that's really challenging for a Medicaid agency is even when they're aware of some of these things or studies going on, both the time demands on real-life decisions and some of the kinds of expertise that lives within Medicaid agencies isn't necessarily about evidence-based evaluation of research that's going on in different states about what's happening. And it was alluded to in my introduction that I'm part of an institute in California, which is a state university partnership with the Medicaid program, and there are several of these developing in a handful of states around the country, Maine, Massachusetts, Maryland, where the state university is working with the Medicaid program to try to help interpret lessons learned from research in the Medicaid programs. And I think that's another way that, in fact, Medicaid programs can benefit internally from some of the resources they have within their states to try to learn how to evaluate evidence. Because it can be very hard if they're getting sort of bombarded with studies that seem to give answers that are 180 degrees opposite and to know whether did one do a better job, is one more valid, and so forth. So I think that's another piece of it.
Well, Andy, this questioner asks you to put on your research hat and elaborate a bit on the role of community health centers as primary care providers versus private physicians, and to what extent are the community health centers really major contributors here, or are we really looking mostly at an issue with private providers?
Right. So, you know, there's no question that community health centers are a place that provide a disproportionate number of a disproportionate amount of care to people in the Medicaid program. But in most parts of the country, it would not be possible for them to do this heavy lifting on their own. And so even though participation rates of private practitioners can be relatively low on average, given that is still the majority of what our delivery system looks like, they need to be a part of the puzzle at this point. Having said that, I think there are ways that community health centers can be need to be bolstered and invested in so that they can, in fact, be kind of the steam engine pulling along the whole system and hoping to create a model of care that might be valuable for all providers involved to participate in. Community health centers are also places that may take care of a disproportionate number of beneficiaries who are of limited English proficiency or other kinds of complex challenges that may be harder to attend to in the private setting. So I think both are important. I think that if you go to different states and to different communities, you'll find a different proportion or involvement of private practitioners versus community health centers. But I don't want to give the impression that it could just be done by the clinics, because private physicians, adding up as a whole, still play a very major role in providing services to Medicaid beneficiaries, particularly as you get into more specialty care and the like.
And Andy, let me just follow up to point out, and those of you who were who missed a round or two in the stimulus saga, if it plays out the way it seems to be playing out, there is a substantial amount of money for community health center infrastructure in that package. And the challenge is going to be what happens inside these newly refurbished infrastructure structures. And if I can offer a commercial, we're going to be doing a briefing on that topic in a couple of weeks, February 23rd. You can mark your calendars, and we'll pick up that conversation right here. Diane?
We've talked a lot today about Medicaid as a program that has a lot of variation across states and that there are mandatory benefits and optional benefits. This question pertains to what is actually an optional benefit under Medicaid, prescription drugs. But the question is, do all states cover that? How does it vary from state to state? Is it really a complete benefit, or are patients still responsible for considerable out-of-pocket costs? How does it help connect them with complementary prescription drug savings programs in some of the states as well? So, Barb?
All states provide the optional outpatient pharmacy benefit. And they do that because they view it as not only critical to good health care delivery, that people have access to medications, but also cost-effective, because while it's technically an optional service, if it's an outpatient service, it's a mandatory service if it's an inpatient service. And what you don't want to do is have people hospitalized to get some amoxicillin. And so every state has the Medicaid outpatient optional pharmacy benefit. When you check the box that says you're going to provide the pharmacy benefit, you have to provide it as the federal law and regulations describe it. And this is one in which states basically have to take all or nothing. There are states that might provide a more reduced pharmacy benefit if they could, but they can't. And that's partly because there is a federal law that cut a very good deal for states with the pharmaceutical manufacturers that said if the manufacturer participates in the federal rebate program that gives rebates directly to states based on drugs that are purchased in the retail marketplace for Medicaid on trade drugs, that if a manufacturer participates in the rebate program, a state Medicaid program has to include all of that manufacturer's drugs in the state's Medicaid program. Okay? So this is one where if you check that box on the state plan, you have to take a very large pharmacy benefit and make it part of your Medicaid program. Now, states do have some ability to manage that program. They can manage it through how they set rates. They can manage it through how they use prior authorization. And in some cases may say, well, you need to, we're not going to prior authorize this drug if you haven't already tried this drug. There's also the ability that states, almost every state now is using, that is that states go directly to those manufacturers and negotiate supplemental additional rebates in order to not prior authorize those drugs. So states have actually done a pretty good job of getting the price, the net cost of drugs down. They probably have some of the best pricing arrangements, net pricing arrangements in the country, and I'm not sure anybody can touch it, except maybe the VA, which actually restricts where you can actually get the drug because it's distributed more narrowly. So they do a very good job of managing the price. A lot of states are struggling more with the issue of managing utilization. And again, managed care is one of the ways states have tried to get a better handle on the utilization of prescription drugs. Ironically, because states cannot get access to the federal rebate, manufacturer rebates, if the pharmacy benefit is provided through the managed care arrangement. A lot of states are now starting to carve the drugs back out of the managed care arrangement in order to retain access to the federal rebate dollars, which is giving them a better net price. But again, they're giving up the advantage of better coordination of care when they do that. So there are some real challenges in managing the pharmacy program, but it is a big program.
And for those in the room who may not have been here when the Medicare drug benefit was passed, prior to the enactment of that, Medicaid provided prescription drugs to the Medicare beneficiaries who were on the Medicaid program and now pays part of the cost of covering those individuals through Medicare through something called the clawback provision. So if you hear about clawbacks, clawbacks have to do with the states continuing to have a maintenance of effort payment that helps subsidize the cost of the Medicare drug benefit.
By the way, we're winding down in this Q&A time that we have left, and let me just ask you, as you're listening to these last few questions and answers, to pull out that blue evaluation form and fill it out before you leave. Diane?
Well, I have a question to me here that asks if any models have been run in regard to seniors who find themselves Medicaid eligible due to reduced pensions or those who lost their retirement nest eggs due to the downturn in the markets. And no, we haven't run any models like that. Data tends to lag well behind economic trends, which is one of the problems. But I think that you can see both on the insurance side as well as I'm sure on the aged and disability side, especially on the aged side, that there are individuals who were previously just above the income eligibility levels for Medicaid that might now have fallen below depending on what they have experienced. It is important, however, to note that while the asset test has pretty much been eliminated for children and many of their parents, there is still a very restrictive asset test in the Medicaid program for the aged and people with disabilities, and that's about $3,000 for a couple, which means that very few people who were really having any kind of a substantial nest egg would at all be eligible for Medicaid, even though they've lost most of what they had in their nest egg.
It might speed up people becoming eligible for long-term care services under Medicaid because they would spend down faster the resources.
But it's worth studying if we could. We also have a question for Barb. Because as she explained the financing, one of our questioners wants to know how it's justified that states tax hospitals and nursing homes for revenue for Medicaid.
Well, it's tax revenue. States can tax all sorts of folks to get revenue. I think that the question really is asking, and this has been sort of controversial in recent years, the idea that you're taxing a healthcare provider who then is participating as a Medicaid provider, and so you can actually raise their rates and basically give them back their tax dollar. And the question at the federal level has been, is there really a state tax dollar in that payment, or is it just some sort of a shell game? And I would just point out that that states that use provider taxes are using those provider taxes pursuant to the federal regulations that make it okay. And one of those requirements is that the tax has to be applied to all of the providers in that provider type. So, for example, in nursing homes, you can't only tax Medicaid providing nursing homes that accept Medicaid patients. You have to tax even those nursing facilities that don't accept Medicaid as a reimbursement. If you're taxing hospitals, you have to tax all hospitals in some sort of an equal way or some sort of a reasonable way, even though hospitals participate very differently in the Medicaid program. Some hospitals are very heavily involved with providing services to the Medicaid population, and some hospitals actually do very little Medicaid business. But they all have to pay the tax. So the idea behind how you make this a legitimate source of payment in the federal regulations is that you have to apply the tax broadly. And there can't be this guarantee that every dime a hospital puts into the tax program is going to get paid back by Medicaid.
This question relates to the federal-state relationship over Medicaid, and it's about what is the time period that a state plan amendment or a state plan is binding. Are states able to amend plans mid-year, assuming HHS approves the plan? And maybe more broadly, could you comment on how states and the federal government have been getting along over these issues?
I want to know who asked this question. This is always asked, and there is a lot of mother may I that goes on around state plan amendments. There are some time periods I don't know. I think they're probably just federal policy with regard to time periods that CMS will make a decision within, I don't know, 90 days of the state plan being filed. But CMS is a master at stopping the clock. And basically it usually goes something like this. Either they'll ask a lot of questions and say, look, we can either just say no, or you state can agree to stop the clock, and so you'll have time to answer the 15 pages of questions we just gave you at the last minute. And so there's a lot. Some state plans can get approved within 90 days, and some state plans may go for a couple of years and not get approved. I think there are some out there right now that have been open that long. So there really is no guarantee about how quickly they get approved. States can file a state plan amendment at any time. So there's no sort of time frame that you only get one shot at this a year. The state plans are enormously large documents, very complicated, and states, you know, can be in there tinkering with different pieces of it on a fairly constant basis.
And the state plan amendment or the state plan stays in effect until the state opts to change it.
Yes, and sometimes states have encouragement. Sometimes in recent years, the conversation has also gone like this. Well, we won't approve the new one you've asked for unless you change something that else you already had approval for and we don't like anymore. So, again, it may be a state option to agree to have made that other change, but states didn't feel much like it was an option, which probably goes toward answering the question, how have the states and the federal government been getting along? It's certainly true that in recent years there has been a great deal of friction, a lot of tension, in part because CMS has been implementing policies that were designed to put what they thought was a very much needed increased a fiscal framework, a fiscal accountability framework within the program and more consistency across states in terms of what states were allowed to do with Medicaid around some issues. Some of that's probably been very needed and been good. There's also been a fairly significant amount, states would argue, of federal policy change that has also been attempted to be implemented through one-on-one negotiations around state plan amendments, and that has caused a great deal of friction with states as well.
Okay. This question is with regard to the pressure on hospitals to provide a certain level of charity care, and does that cause less effort by patients and providers to get enrolled in Medicaid because they can just go to a public hospital?
If I'm understanding the question, are you saying by coming to a public hospital they're not?
It's the pressure on hospitals to provide a level of charity care, and
yes.
Does this then retard the effort to enroll people and get them insured?
Right. Well, I can't speak to all hospitals. I will say at San Francisco General Hospital, the public hospital in San Francisco where I practice, And I don't think this is atypical for a lot of public hospitals, at least in California. We have many eligibility workers on site who very aggressively pursue opportunities to try to enroll potentially eligible people for the Medicaid program. In fact, if you look at the state hospital discharge data in many states, you will find that many people are recorded as being covered by Medicaid because hospitals make presumptions in many cases of the possible eligibility of someone for the Medicaid program, even though later on they may learn that for some particular reason the person did not entirely qualify. So, you know, in general, I would say in the marketplaces that I'm familiar with, hospitals are quite aggressive about pursuing opportunities to enroll people in the Medicaid program. Now, there are reasons that certain hospitals may be particularly aggressive and interested in that we didn't emphasize so much today, but there are programs called DISH, Disproportionate Share Hospitals, that take care of greater portions of Medicaid patients, and they will get reimbursed. First of all, if their patient is on Medicaid on a sort of daily rate that they negotiate with their state Medicaid program, but depending on the state and how the program is structured, typically if they exceed certain thresholds of having a certain number of their days paid for by Medicaid, they will be able to get additional dollars to support that hospital that are not tied to care of that individual patient, but that are available for supporting the infrastructure of the institution in general as a hospital that provides a lot of charity care for Medicaid patients and those who are uninsured. So it's interesting that the questioner is raising whether there's sort of a disincentive to do this, given a hospital may want to have a certain amount of charity write-off anyway. I could imagine certain circumstances that hospitals might do that, but again, in the marketplace that I see in San Francisco, there is a very aggressive attempt, and looking at our state hospital discharge data, to try to find people who are eligible for the program. One of the probably biggest challenges around that for hospitals to try to sort through, and different localities have different views about this, has to do with some of the issues around immigrant populations and their eligibility and some of the sensitivities around some of the issues that are raised about federal rules about who is eligible for Medicaid and different localities, San Francisco being an example, that does not try to record and capture that information because it's a sanctuary city on that basis. So there may be some locality differences that come into play as well.
This question relates to the six Bush administration Medicaid regulations that have been subject to a moratoria, and asks the speakers to comment on what the impact of these regulations would have been, what the impact of the moratoria is.
Without going into a lot of detail on this, the tension that I was describing between the states and the federal administration was for many years one in which there really weren't any written guidance from CMS as to how they were making those decisions. Toward the end of the administration, the Bush administration, CMS issued a large number of regulations. Some of them proposed regulations that then went through, you know, a public comment period and were have to be final filed. Some of them issued as interim final regulations, which meant after a comment period they became effective, to deal with a lot of these issues and to sort of say, here's in fact what we think ought to be the policy and the regulations. States were enormously upset with many of those regulations. Providers, in many cases, were very upset with some of those regulations. Advocates were upset with many of those regulations. There was a very interesting coming together of many different people around this broad range and this large volume of regulations that were issued. Some of them have to do with the rehabilitation option in Medicaid, targeted case management in Medicaid. Some of them had to do with how public hospitals and public providers could be paid and when an IGT or a CPE was valid. It was broad-ranging in terms of the kinds of things that were dealt with these regulations. There was such an uproar over the regulations and, in some cases, the method in which the regulations were being promulgated, often with very limited public comment periods, that states finally turned to Congress and said, we just need these to be put in abeyance for a while. Some of the regulations had been put into moratorium by Congress earlier, and then as more regulations came out, states sort of banded together with providers and others and said, could we just put a halt here and step back and take a look at these regulations and see whether they really make sense and which ones do and which ones don't. What's happening is that these regulations were the moratorium was set to expire April 1st of 2009. Some of the regulations were actually in effect when the moratorium took effect. So if nothing happens on April 1st, 2009, they go back into effect. Some of them were only proposed regulations, which means the new administration would have to decide whether to finalize them or not. So, again, you can't say the same thing about all six regs. And I believe that the stimulus package has extended the moratorium on all of them or some of them. Some of them, not all of them. Do you want me to read this? This was one of the things in the plane this morning. I kept saying, I'm not sure I have the right list on this issue. It extends the moratorium on Medicaid regulations for targeted case management, provider taxes, and school-based administration and transportation services through June 30, 09, adds a moratorium on Medicaid regulation for hospital outpatient services through June 30, 2009, And then there was sort of the sense of Congress that was described in this, that the Secretary of HHS should not promulgate regulations concerning intergovernmental transfers, graduate medical education, and rehabilitation services at all. So as you can see, Congress has been pulled way into this discussion between the federal administrative agencies and the states, and I would anticipate that some of this conversation is going to be ongoing even with the new administration.
Diane, we have time for one more question.
Well, I think that we should wrap up with the sense of our questioners about Medicaid being wrongly thought about as a program that people are looking for a handout, asking what the government can do to eliminate this misconception. And another question saying, but what are the most problematic components of Medicaid and how are they being reformed? Because I think the two go hand in hand.
You know, one of the challenges we have with Medicaid is we have a real love-hate relationship with it. We turn to Medicaid over and over again to solve problems in other parts of the healthcare financing system. Things that aren't covered by commercial insurance, things that aren't covered by Medicare, let's let Medicaid take care of that. Services, people who in fact cannot afford coverage in the private marketplace, let's let Medicaid take care of that. People who in fact have health problems that cause them to not be welcome in the commercial marketplace, let's let Medicaid take care of that. So we want and we need and we use Medicaid to support some really important public policy in this country. And in fact, in services like in the mental health world, Medicaid is the single largest payer of mental health services in this country and is providing over half of all funding that's public funding for mental health. So we have increasingly got a very broad network of the safety net and some of very critical public programs that are dependent upon Medicaid as their primary source of financing. I don't think it's about people that just have their hands out. I think it's about people who have very serious health care problems who don't find a viable alternative someplace else in our larger system. At the same time, I think that's probably the single largest challenge that we have, is trying to figure out how to effectively manage services to the sickest folks in our health care system, in our country, the people that are most vulnerable, the people that are going to need lifelong care. How do you do that effectively, and how do you finance that effectively? Because I think one of the challenges Medicaid and states deal with is that we are increasingly providing services to non-poverty populations, particularly among the disability community and the aged, through Medicaid, because it's the only thing there is. But the financing structure for Medicaid sort of presumes it's a poverty program. And I think that when you realize that's 70% of the spending in the program, we really ought to go back and take a look and see, do we have our arms around how you really manage a program for frail, vulnerable, chronically ill populations. The other thing I always want to say when I'm inside the Beltway is 40% of spending in Medicaid, 40% is for people that are already fully insured through Medicare. And yet Medicare policy is established separate from the Medicaid program. The two programs are administered separately. There is no real collaboration and coordination between those programs for the beneficiary. 40% of the spending is for about 13% of the enrolled population in Medicaid, and they're already fully insured by Medicare. We've got to come back and take a look at those parts of the programs and begin to make these systems of coverage more rational.
Yes, I can put in a little ad here. Today we just put up a new series of two policy briefs on our website, kff.org, on the dual eligible population and the financing challenges and some options for restructuring the financing between the federal government and the states. Andy?
Yeah, I'll just underscore some of the comments that were made. I mean, the challenges that we face in this country with regard to access to care that we're all familiar with related to the uninsured would be twice as large today were we not to have the Medicaid program. The Medicaid program goes an enormous way to providing access to the care to really the most vulnerable people in this country. And I can't say that, you know, maybe I've been duped and haven't realized that I've sometimes taken care of someone who was looking for a handout, but it sure doesn't feel that way every day working in a public hospital clinic where patients work very hard to try to keep themselves healthy. They're suffering from a lot of different kinds of challenges in their lives. And I would say that I think one of the things that we really need to look at to reform is how to simplify the program to allow it to work and not just be a Band-Aid at the most expensive last minute for patients, but to, in fact, make sure that it's there as a continuity coverage, a comprehensive coverage, to allow people to really see this as a safety net program that can help them get back on the path toward health and to become as active as they can in our society, whether that be working or engaging in other kinds of work. So I think it's an incredibly critical program for access to care. It's not to say that there aren't things about it that could be better, but I think we're very fortunate to at least have this as part of our safety net, and I think there are opportunities through the kinds of things that we've talked about today to explore ways to make it an even more solid safety net for the most vulnerable in this country.
That's great. Well, thank you both. Those are all three of you, some very insightful comments. Let me just ask one more time, if you haven't done so already, to please share your feedback with us on the evaluation forms. And that goes for you folks who are watching the webcast as well. If you go to the website, just on the allhealth.org website, there is a version of the evaluation form that you can either fill out online or print and fax to us. We'd appreciate it if you could do that. Let me thank Kaiser Family Foundation and its commission for helping us put this event together and providing one of the stellar speakers. We thank you for sticking with us through a description of a complicated program that gets ever more complicated as we speak, and ask you to join me in thanking our panelists for a lot of help in helping to understand this program.